Good morning. Oh, I heard a good morning, Justin. All right, great. Not just a generic good morning. Very good. If you want to open your Bibles to 1 Corinthians, we're going to be spending some time there this morning. By a show of hands, how many families do we have in town because of Sing Song? All right, pretty good number. How many of you actually went to Sing Song this weekend? Very good. Good deal. Yeah, Carrie and I were, we decided to take Harper to Sing Song, and we had an absolute wonderful time. It was great for Harper to get to go to a show that she didn't have to worry about being quiet during, you know. So she was hooting and hollering and having a blast, and it was, you know, we were disturbing everyone around us. It was great. We had a great time, and for those of you in the show, I just want you to know that yours was my favorite, above all. Congratulations, by the way, to the Coyotes. Good job, guys, on winning. But yeah, it was a great show, and if you've never been to one of these, or if you've never been a part of one, it's hard to imagine how much work goes into putting these shows together. How many hours and hours, day after day, week after week, is put into developing one of these shows. You know, everybody's, you know, they have songs to learn and music to learn and the moves to go over and the timings to get right. And it's very difficult, and it takes a whole lot of work, a whole lot of dedication to make one of these shows function like it's supposed to, like it's designed to. And it's funny, if you spend any time in our group or you walk around campus, you'll see students just randomly break out into, you know, doing these moves or singing these songs, trying to, you know, remind themselves or go over a particular piece of choreography that they couldn't get. And if you don't know what's going on, it kind of looks like they just got stuck in a spider web or something. You know, they're just doing these things, and it's just very, you don't know what's going on. And they do that because they're nervous. Because they know if they don't get their part right, they know if they don't perform exactly like they're supposed to, people will notice and the show won't be able to function like it's supposed to. It reminds me a lot of a playset I have in my backyard. And I know this is a big stretch, but go with me for a second. It reminds me of this playset. Last year, Carrie and I, with the aid of my parents and her parents, got Harper one of these big wooden playsets for our backyard. You know, the kind that you see at Lowe's or Academy or places like that. And I went there and we were looking, we did all the research, we checked all the different ones, and they always came with two prices. They had one price and then another price that was about $200 or so more. And I asked about it. It's like, well, what is this other price? And they said, that's for having it delivered and somebody to set it up for you in your backyard. I was like, oh, well, you know, I don't need that. You know, I got a screwdriver at home. You know, I was like, I can do this. It's no big deal. So I mustered up as much manitude as I could. And I told them that, you know, I'm going to do it myself. So I borrowed a trailer and I went and got it, and it's this gigantic box that weighs about 3,000 pounds. And I finally got that dude in my backyard, and it had this little wording on the side that said, some assembly required. Now, it wasn't flashing neon, it wasn't even red that said, danger! This is a lie! Because it should have said, long hours of frustrating, extremely difficult work ahead of you. Do not undertake unless you really love your kids. That is what it should have said. But, you know, after several days, lots of sweat, a lot of broken pieces, I finally got it done. But it's difficult. The instructions don't make any sense most of the time. They're confusing. They've been translated from, you know, probably some other language, and there's 100 different pieces that you got to figure out how they all go together, and if you don't get it right, your child is going to die. I mean, that's how you feel when you look at these instructions. But once you get it all together, it works and functions beautifully. You know, and so these two things have something in common, right? They're taking a lot of different intricate pieces that all have its part to play, and they come together to form one unit, to form one show. You know, I think Paul had this kind of cohesion in mind when he wrote 1 Corinthians. Last week we talked about unity, the unity of believers, about us all coming together for God's plan, for His purpose, about our love and relationships being such that the world will see it and know that we are different, that our relationships, how we interact with one another, will make a difference in this world. Paul writes to the Corinthians, and I think he has this in mind. He knows that it takes every single piece working diligently together in order to form the true nature of God's church. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, he says, "I appeal to you, brothers, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that all of you agree, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you may be united in the same mind and in the same judgment." Now, we've heard this before. Last week, we heard very similar verses to this in Philippians. But the difference is, in Philippians, there was really one main conflict. The relationship between two different people was kind of tearing the church apart and causing them not to function like they needed to. Yet, in Corinthians, Paul is writing to a bunch of different churches who are not only divided with the different churches, but they're also divided in and of themselves. And there are many, many issues. They're divided along lines of who they were taught by. In chapter 1, verse 12, Paul talks about, you know, "I hear that there is quarreling among you." Because some of you are saying, "Well, Paul taught me," or "Apollos taught me," or "I follow Cephas," or "I follow this person." So they were using their teachers, the people who were teaching them, to say, you know, "We're the ones who are better." They were divided by thoughts of superiority, saying, you know, "We're the super Christians. We're better than you guys because we have this teacher, or we have, you know, this person who started us." They were divided by the way they dealt with sin in the church. In chapter 5, Paul talks about some of the immorality that was going on in the churches. And they couldn't agree on how to deal with it and how to proceed. They were divided by lawsuits. You know, we have in Corinth rich mingling with the poor. And this caused all kinds of issues. One of those issues was some of the richer Christians, to get their way, were taking their poorer brothers and sisters in Christ to court because they knew that they didn't have the money to afford lawyers. As rich Christians, they were probably associating with the judges and the other lawyers, and so they had an in. And rightly or wrongly, they were given their way. And Paul is saying this should not be the case. They were divided on whether or not they should marry in chapter 7. They were divided by what they ate, chapters 8 and 9. They were divided by social classes and how they participated in communion. It's hard to imagine churches being divided by so many different things. And as we talked about last week, and as common sense has to dictate in the most technical terms possible, this ain't good. It's not good. God's church should not be divided in this way. This kind of division has no place in His church. It destroys us. It makes us look bad to others. It makes people see us and go, "There's nothing really unique there. There's nothing special there. They're just like everybody else." When Peter writes his first letter, he writes in ideal terms about what the church should be like. He calls us a royal priesthood. The priesthood is thought of as one unit, acting on behalf of God, acting for God. He says, "You guys are a royal priesthood, all of you as one, acting on behalf of God." He calls us a spiritual house, each of us having a part to play, each of us building this church and making it what it should be, with no one left behind. This morning, I want to talk about one of the areas he spends a lot of time with, spiritual gifts. Besides the social and economic divisions that the members were experiencing, they also started using the gifts that God had given them to classify members. In chapter 1, verse 7, he says that they indeed have spiritual gifts. He calls them manifestations of grace. But then in chapter 12, in verse 1, he says, "Concerning spiritual gifts, I do not want you to be uninformed." So he says, yeah, you guys have gifts. God has given you gifts, but I'm concerned about how you're using them. They were making into a power play, into a power thing. There are those who are saying, "Well, because I have the gift of speaking or teaching, it's much more public, and therefore it brings me more honor, and therefore must be a better gift. Because I have this gift, I am better than you. I am more favored by God." And so they began to draw these lines. They started boasting about these gifts, about how their gifts were better. And so Paul writes to correct that assumption. Look with me in chapter 12, verse 4. Paul writes that there are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit. And there are varieties of service, but the same Lord, and varieties of activities, but it is the same God who empowers them all in everyone. To each is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. Now, by saying this, he's making two statements here. One, he's saying that their boasting about their gifts is pointless. It'd be a lot like me boasting about how I'm the tallest person in my family, as though I had anything to do with it. Now, I spent a lot of time as a kid hanging from ledges, trying to make myself taller. Has anybody ever heard that myth? If you hang from a ledge, you'll grow taller. I have. They got pictures of me hanging from ledges as I was a kid because I wanted to be tall. It was my one main goal. But I didn't have anything to do with it. It was genetics. God made me the way I am. Paul says, you have no reason to boast about your gifts because they are not from you, they are from me. The second thing he does is he says that all varieties of gifts and service and activities are empowered by God. By listing all these three things, he closes the loopholes. If he would have only said all gifts are empowered by God, people would have said, yeah, but he's really just talking about my gifts. But instead, he says that all gifts, service, and activities are done in God's name and for God's kingdom are all equal because they are all from God. Paul also has a word for those who might try to shirk their responsibility and say, you know, I don't have anything. There's nothing I can do. God hasn't given me any gifts. Well, Paul says, each one of you has been given a gift of the Spirit. A friend of mine in one of the churches that I used to work for was a deacon, and he had a very difficult time finding his place, finding his ministry to serve in. When he became a deacon, he was given one ministry and just never could seem to make it work. And so he was reassigned into another ministry, and then again and again and again. And eventually he got so discouraged he was thinking about stepping down and just stepping back altogether and you know, not doing anything. And so I talked with him, I met with him, and you know, I asked him why this was going on. He said, you know, I'm not useful. There's nothing I can do. I can't make anything work. And so I started asking him, what are you passionate about? What are the things that you really care about? And it turns out this guy was an amazing listener. He was able to meet with people, to listen to their needs, and discover what they really needed and how to help them. But because our church didn't have a particular ministry that was available for him or that fit that need, he felt like he couldn't do anything. I think it's time for us to stop trying to put round pegs into square holes. So many times we just try to stick people where we think they ought to go instead of asking them, what is your gift? How can you best serve God? And then creating a ministry for them. We need to empower people to identify their gifts, either find a place that is already in place to serve in, or maybe create a new ministry for them. They created a benevolence and outreach ministry that they somehow didn't have already for this guy, and he took it and made something incredible with it. I believe it is our responsibility to identify our gifts, whatever they are, because the purpose for the gifts that we have been given is the betterment of our community. Paul wrote in verse 7 that all of these things are given to us for the common good. So what are these gifts? What are the variety of spiritual gifts that we have been given? In verses 8 through 10, he lists some of these, and this is by no means a comprehensive list. You can find others in Romans 12 and Ephesians 4 and even later on in this chapter. But if you were to compile all the various spiritual gifts, it might list something like this. And I want you to pay attention to these. I want you to think about where your gifts may lie, how you may be able to serve. Gifts of helping, of leadership, of hospitality, of service. Gifts of administration and discernment. Gifts of faith and craftsmanship, gifts of healing and giving, mercy, wisdom, knowledge, exhortation, the gift of teaching, the gift of being a shepherd, missionary, evangelist, or the gift of intercessory prayer. We all minister differently because we have been gifted differently, but it is the same God that is at work in all of us. He customizes His work through us for His glory and the strength of His church. Last year, we were taking a group picture in our university group, and someone who shall remain nameless dropped a cup of coffee. And it was interesting because you could see a lot of these gifts play out in the interactions around us. I saw the gift of prophecy when someone said, "Hey, that's what happens when you're not careful." I saw the gift of service. Several students just left and then got some towels and immediately come back and started cleaning it up. I saw the gift of teaching. Someone was like, "Well, you see, you weren't really holding it right. You didn't have your hand under it, and it was kind of hot, and then you got bumped, you dropped it, and oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that." There was the gift of exhortation. "Hey, next time, maybe you should let someone else hold that for you." You know, that I'm not so sure that was helpful. But then there was the gift of mercy, those patting her, I mean, whoever it was, on the back and saying, "Hey, you know, don't feel too bad about it. Everybody does that. It just happened to be you this time." If you ever want to see what people's spiritual gifts are, just drop some water or drop something sometime, and you know, maybe not on the carpet, but you know, see how people react. Their spiritual gifts will come out. Paul wrote in verse 11 that all these are empowered by one and the same Spirit who apportions each one individually as He wills. Today is a Teacher Appreciation Sunday. After services in the NPR, we are going to celebrate our teachers. Teachers do an amazing job, and they have a difficult job, and they are tasked with something very important. And I'm sure almost every one of us could point to a teacher we've had in our life that has made an incredible impact on our lives. And so we are grateful and we're thankful for those who've been given the gift of teaching. But whether your gift is one of teaching or quietly serving in a line at Laugh or leading singing, God needs you and you're important. If your gift is one of leadership, it makes you no more important than one whose gift is that of a follower. Should you find yourself being drawn to grief ministry, youth ministry, family, or children's ministry, it is all the same, and God needs you in His church. If you have the gift of service, fill communion trays, visit the sick, or lead someone in a Bible study, or build a ramp, or give an ear to someone in need, you are a better sermon than the one I'm preaching this morning, and God needs you in His church. When all these pieces can come together and form the true body of the church, God is pleased. In verse 12, he begins to drive his point home when he says, "For the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one. And so it is with Christ. For in one Spirit we were all baptized into one body, Jews or Greeks, slaves or free, and we were all made to drink of the one Spirit. For the body does not consist of one, but of many." God draws all His people together with their pasts, their backgrounds, no matter who they are or where they come from. He draws them together and says, "You are no longer a part of that world, you are a part of mine." And He shapes us and He molds us into the true picture of His church. You know, when Harper asks me to come and play on her playset, she doesn't go, "Hey, Dad, I really want to go play on that half-inch piece of wood in the upper deck in the left-hand corner." You know, she doesn't do that. She sees the whole thing as a whole and how it functions. The way those sing-song shows work, if one person is out of place or one person has forgot their role, it doesn't function like it should. In the same way, the church, when people don't use their gifts that they have been given, it cannot function the way it should. He starts to ask a whole bunch of silly questions starting in verse 15. He says, "If the body were a big floating eyeball, how could you hear? Where would your glasses hang? You'd get really dried out because there'd be no big eyelid to blink all the time." He says, "If the whole body were an ear, how could you smell? Further, I feel like it would be ridiculous if we were all ears and no one was a mouth." Think about that for a second. You know that phrase, "all dressed up and no place to go"? It'd give new meaning to that. You'd have to change it to "big old ear with nothing to hear." You know, that's funny. Think about it for a second. You know, Paul's trying to make a point, though, right? He's trying to say if we are all the same, if we all try to serve in the same way, then we don't go anywhere. The most important part of the car, you could argue, is the gas and the tank, or it's the steering wheel, or it's the wheels, or it's the seat, or it's the engine. But the truth is, they are all equally important, and without one piece, it cannot function as it was meant to. The church is that way. We are all called to serve God. We are all called and we are all given gifts. If we do not use our gifts, the church cannot function the way God intended it to function. The eye cannot say to the hand, "I have no need of you." The head cannot say to the feet, "I have no need of you." The truth is, we need each other. God needs us. He wants us to work together with our gifts. I love the show, The Extreme Makeover Home Edition, because it shows what people can accomplish when they work together. It shows what people can do if they all come together for a common purpose, using the gifts that they have been given, working in the tasks that they have been assigned. This morning, I want to encourage you. I want you to read over the scriptures that talk about spiritual gifts. I want you to decide what they mean. I want you to take a look at your own life and examine your talents and the things that God has given you. And ask yourself, are you using those to better your community? Are you using those to further God's purpose for His church, the salvation of souls? This morning, we want to offer an invitation. If you have not been using your gifts the way God has called you to, and you would like to figure out how to do that, how to fit in, we can help you. Maybe you need to join His church for the first time and put on Christ in baptism. We can help you with that. Please come while we stand and sing.